we had to deal with thousands of people sleeping on the airport floor. And they're all yelling at you, the airline, like, it's your job to get me back. And you'd be like, we can't fly. There was no reason why AirAsiaX should have survived its first year.
Azran Osman Rani.
The man behind it all is the CEO, Azran Osman Rani.
Azran was the co-founding CEO of AirAsiaX and co-founded and led the video on-demand service iFlix.
The CEO of AirAsiaX.
Before the finishing line, I collapsed, blacked out, and woke up in the ambulance.
No.
I thought, as a leader, we're supposed to be decisive and take bold actions during crisis, right? That's what I thought. And I stood my ground because I said, you guys are wrong. Like, this is the right strategy. Nobody actually likes it when you stand the ground, right? And I was asked to leave. Then I said, hey, we give your customer free car, then we sell them gasoline. Right? I felt back against the wall, no more answers. Could you have handled that situation differently? Oh, to summarize it, and this is the biggest lesson.
I read your book.
Thank you.
I loved your book, and it's been one of the best books I read lately.
Thank you.
And there's one story that particularly I enjoy that tells me a lot how you handle failure and also your growth mindset, which is your journey to become a triathlon athlete.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So can you tell us, like, in this journey, what were your thoughts and your feelings?
Well, I think first, the start of the journey was never about, I want to be a triathlete. Yeah. There wasn't that clear goal in mind. In fact, I was a competitive athlete in university. But the first 10 years of my career, 80-hour work weeks, traveling, dinners, 10 o'clock room service in a hotel, quickly became unfit, overweight, burnt out. Even right up to starting the airline, right, 2007, 2008, go through periods of being yo-yo, right? Like, you try to get a bit healthy, then work piles up and all of that. And we were invited to sponsor the 2008 inaugural Borneo Marathon. And as a sponsor, you know, I started trying to encourage my team to go and participate, right? So we took 50 people to fly to Kota Kinabalu for the marathon. And as a leader, you're like, well, you got to show up, right? So I signed up for a 10K run. And that was like horrifying for me to actually run 10 kilometers. I thought I was going to die. And the finishing line is in a stadium. And we got to sit in the stadium to wait for the people who ran the full 42-kilometer marathon. And when they finally crossed the line, right, 4, 5, 6 hours of running, and some of them were grandmothers and grandfathers, right, with the biggest smiles on their face. I'm thinking, they just ran 4 times more than what I did. And they're crossing the lines with the biggest smiles. And I thought, you know, my whole guts were going to come out. And it really intrigued me, you know, like seeing what compels someone to just keep going when your body, you know, is screaming to stop, but you can somehow override that. That I felt was very interesting. And so I signed up for a next local community race. It was a 15-kilometer run. Tried running it. Before the finishing line, I collapsed, blacked out, and woke up in the ambulance.
No.
So just because you've got the right desire, determination, but if you don't know what to do, you could end up in a really bad place. But then, when you're really smacked on, you realize, what did I do wrong? Right, like, clearly something is not right here, because grandparents can complete a full 42-kilometer marathon, and I had then not even turned 40 yet. Like, what's missing? And that's the part that bugged me, right? Like, if I don't know something, so start reading about it, and someone then introduced me to a running coach. I said, oh, this is interesting. Tell me more. I thought running is just running, right? And he met him in Singapore. He took me to his lab on a treadmill with all kinds of things that he was measuring my blood lactate levels every 5 minutes at different speeds and different heart rates and oxygen and carbon dioxide. And then he said, well, these are your heart rate zones. You really need to build a foundation first. So I'm going to need you for the next 2 to 3 months to just run. I don't care what speed, but you've got to stay within, say, 120 to 140 beats per second. I'm like, oh, okay, this is precise. So got myself a heart rate monitor, went back to KL and started running. I immediately called him and said, this is not going to work. Because I didn't even like run yet. I was just like brisk walking and I was already going above 140. So he goes, well, then slow down. I said, well, if I slow down, I'm going to just be walking. So he goes, start walking then. I said, but my grandmother can run faster than this, right? He goes, but you haven't built the foundation. And that's kind of where you start to learn that simply starting something you think it seems like you can. Like I can run fast, but you don't see what's going on inside, right? The body's in a distressed state. It's trying to just survive. You're not getting any better. Like you're just continuously putting your heart and your body in a distressed state without that foundation in place. And but he's spending a whole year working with him. I actually eventually became able to run, you know, full marathons under 4 hours because we just spent time walking.
Wow.
Right? And eventually that led to running 12, 13, 14 full marathons around the world.
So like if we bring it now to a company, let's say in AirAsia X, mm-hmm. I think it was incredible what you did going mm-hmm. from zero to a IPO.
Mm-hmm.
I know there were a lot of challenges around the way. What has been one of the challenges that you had and how did you overcome?
Okay, so, I mean, obviously first, even just launching an airline. I started in July, I think 1st July 2007. The first flight was 2nd November 2007, 4 months. In that 4 months, we had to raise money. We raised about $115 million. We had to find the first plane. We found an old plane in Louisiana. And my small team had to figure out how to fly it back from Louisiana to Kuala Lumpur. All in 4 months, no sleep. Now, as much as starting the airline under that circumstance might seem like it was difficult, boy, within a few months of launching it, 2008 happened. The global financial crisis, right? And that time, we were so confident because, you know what, we raised a lot of money, but in hindsight, it didn't have anything to do with me. It was just timing. 2008, everything disappeared. Even the banks who had signed aircraft financing loans said, we're going to exercise this clause, which says material adverse circumstance or force majeure. There's a global crisis. We're going to back out of our loan obligations. Now you're stranded. But there's so many things. I mean, that's a whole story by itself. But just in that same time of the financial crisis, oil prices, right, moved in a way that it had never done before. 2007, when you write your business plan, like, what's the price of oil? We look backwards, right? Okay, study 2002 to 2007, it was like hovering between 50 and 75. Let's put $75 in our business plan. And when we launched in November, it was $75 a barrel. In the first 6 months of 2008, where do you think oil was in June of 2008?
More than 100?
$147,
virtually
doubling. Now, think about the journey in the weeks and months since it's going up, right? You're not panicking. Because oil is like our biggest cost, right? It's almost 50% of our cost. And your board members, your investors are screaming at you. And you know what they all said? You need to hedge your fuel. So hedging of the fuel means you go to the bank and you say, hey, I don't like fuel volatility. What can I do to fix my fuel cost? Okay, you sign this fuel hedging instrument. Now it says going up, maybe it's like $90 a barrel. The bank says, no problem. I can give you a fixed rate for the next 12 months, $100. Because the bank always makes a spread, right? And you do it because everybody's expecting you to do it, right? And it kept going all the way to 147. And you're like, wow, hey, I'm smart, right? Like, and because your accountant's now telling you that difference from your $100 contract and the spot price of 147, you can book that as profit on your P&L. And we were like, dude, like I'm like this star first amazing, airline. I'm an amazing, you know, CEO, right? This one piece of paper, I can just ground my plane and, you know, wow, what a fantastic way to make money. King of the world. That was June of 2008. Where do you think the price of oil was? December 2008. Just 6 months after that. So first 6 months it went up. Where do you think it where did you think it went in the next 6 months?
No way.
Take a guess.
It was below 50?
32. $32, right? You've just locked it in at $100. At that price, right? Technically, according to the fuel hedging contract, the counterparty, the bank who we signed that contract with, could have claimed four times more than our entire capital, wiping us out. There was no reason why AirAsia X should have survived its first year, except for a very important business principle called SDL. Have any of your guests talked to you about this very important business strategy? SDL stands for sheer dumb luck. Because it just so happens, of all the banks that we could have signed this contract with, the one bank that we did sign with, you know who that bank was? Lehman Brothers. And that was the year Lehman Brothers collapsed. You know, 2010, we started flights to London in 2009. You might remember this, but there was an Icelandic volcanic eruption that shut down the entire European airspace. Right, we had thousands of passengers stranded in Kuala Lumpur, thousands in London. We were all freaking because every airline couldn't fly, right? So you survived that. 2011, the next year, we had flights to Tokyo, Japan. Oh. And there was the Tohoku earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear tragedy, where half your passengers, I don't want to fly. Give me a refund. The other half says, I need you to fly me. I've got very important family or you know, business issues. Your pilots are like, radiation, I don't want to fly, right? How do you deal with that, right? 2012, we started flights to Christchurch, New Zealand. Not one, but two big earthquakes. Okay, everywhere we flew, the world shook. Yeah. 2013 was the only year that kind of the world didn't shake, and we completed the IPO. But just as soon as we completed the IPO, 2014 happened, where not one, not two, three black swan events, right? March 2014, MH370, the plane that was missing, still missing today. July, MH17 that was shot down over Ukraine. And December, QZ8501, a fatal plane crash. Although none of the three were the ones under me, but the impact to our business was brutal because, you know, I thought I came up with the perfect logical strategy, convinced all these IPO investors on the north-south axis strategy, where we would build leadership positions in China and Australia, connecting North Asia to Australia, right? But those three incidents cause travel demand from these two markets, which are now like over 60% of your business, to completely collapse. So it never stops.
Oh my God.
It never stopped.
But what have you learned from that experience?
Well, I think number one, you realize, you know, and I'll tell you why that 2014 thing perhaps is the culmination of this learning. that in life, it's not necessarily about like what is the right logical answer to a problem, but building trust. And we started this conversation about trust, right? Because here's what happened. As this crisis happened, our share price is plummeting. Our revenues are crashing. We were losing a lot of money. I thought as a leader, we're supposed to be decisive and take bold actions during crisis, right? That's what I thought. And I came up with what I thought was a sound, logical strategy, which on paper, I still think it is today, right? I'll tell you why. You tell me what's wrong with the strategy. I said, okay, travel demand from our core markets have collapsed. I'm going to take 50% of our aircraft capacity and lease them out to other airlines for about a year because they're European airlines who need extra flights for summer charters to the Caribbean, North African carriers who need extra flights for Umrah and Hajj pilgrimage flights, so that at least this capacity will earn some money. If you leave it in your core markets and there's not enough demand, it'll just be bleeding cash. And so I said, by leasing out this capacity, and I denominate those leasing contracts in US dollars, at least I reduce our currency mismatch, right? I can now at least get 50% of my revenues in dollars. Good strategy?
Well, it looks good.
It looks solid, right?
Yeah.
But my board disagreed.
Then?
They just wanted to stay the course. And I stood my ground because I said, no, you guys are wrong. Like, this is the right strategy. Nobody actually likes it when you stand the ground, right? And I was asked to leave. For a year afterwards, I was filled with anger, resentment, right? And the airline continued to bleed cash, share price continued to fall. And I said, see, should have done what I told him to do, right? But just simply saying that, does it mean I'm in a better off position? No. Is the airline in a better off position? No. Mm-hmm. So what's the point of being kind of quote unquote logically right? To summarize it, and this is the biggest lesson for me, right? You asked about what did I learn from it? So number one, it's not about whether there is a right logical answer. Even though we're all trained, right? We all come from technical professions. There is a right answer. But I failed to connect before I correct.
Wow. That's so good. And I think it's just in so many parts of our life, so many things that happen. It's like, I love, it's about first, you need to connect. And second comes all the correct, all the rational part.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
So
good. Because humans, we're emotional creatures first.
That's it.
Right?
That's it. What a lesson. Wow.
Yeah. So I'm still making a lot of mistakes in my life. I'm sure I'll still come up with more. Yeah.
But what I like, and that's what I like about your book, is like you are open about it. You know, it's like there's, for you, it's all about growth. Mm. You know, you go for it, you learn and you keep going, you know, and you share it openly. Mm. And I love your vulnerability and how you are sharing here, because for sure it can inspire other people, you know, so that they don't go through the same. So I love that.
Thank you.
If you have been getting value from our videos, don't forget to subscribe so we can give you even better content and you can stay updated with new episodes. So hit that subscribe button and I commit to bring you an even better show. Do you remember a time where you went into a situation where you didn't know what to do? And how did you overcome it?
Early 2012 or late 2011, the airline was running out of cash. We were running on fumes, like we were going to not be able to survive. And our major fuel supplier, the guys came and said, you know, if you don't pay, we cannot give you any more credit lines. We're going to have to stop fueling your planes. The moment they do that, that is the end. Because the moment you publicly no fuel, no flights, flights canceled. No one's going to fly with you ever again, right? And I had no answer. I didn't know what to do. I don't know how to solve it, right? And the fuel guy said, sorry, you know, corporate policy. No more credit. So I literally got an appointment to see the CEO of our fuel supplier. And I just begged. You know, I said, look, I really just need 30 days. I didn't even have a plan on how I could pay him back or where I could get the cash. You know, and literally, I remember begging, right? And maybe he got on the right side of the bed that morning. He just said, okay, 30 days. In that 30 days, somehow, we figured out, like, okay, can we restructure some of the deposits held by our engine manufacturers that gives us another 30 days? And then we find another solution that gave us another 30 days, right? Sometimes, you know, it's not like we're told as leaders you have to have answers and have a plan. But sometimes maybe it's okay to just ask for help without a plan.
When you started iFlix, mm-hmm. you know, so you did a lot of iterations to find what's the right business model, right? In order to go from zero to 20 million people in 20 countries, right?
And the answer was never in the business plan.
Exactly. Tell me more about that.
Right. You always start a venture thinking, yeah, this is the plan, right? And you got to convince investors, and investors buy the plan and they back you. Mm. First of all, the journey to finding capital was insane. I look back, we were comparing notes. We were rejected by 115 investors. But what we learned is every pitch you ask them, what did you like about it, right? Half the time, they won't even bother telling you. Mm-hmm. They'll just ghost you, right? But you'll get some feedback, and you tweak, and you change, and you tweak, and you change. Until we found investor number 116 from the Philippines, right? Who probably thought you were, you guys are probably crazy enough to pull this off and give us that first funding to start, right? And when we started, we're like, hey, okay, since the positioning is emerging markets, right? And let's say in Malaysia, we have Astro, the satellite TV, just like you have StarHub in Singapore and all these pay television services around, right? And let's say in Malaysia, the average subscription for pay television was 100 ringgit, $20. We say, hey, let's go to the market. You do kind of what Netflix does, offer a 30-day free trial. And then if you like our content, convert to be a paid subscriber for only 10 ringgit. $2, right? What, 10 times cheaper, right? 90% cheaper. Isn't that a good deal? When we launched it in a few months, we had about 200 paying subscribers. 80 or 100 of them were probably my own friends and family members that I called and arm twisted and said, you know, subscribe, right? And I had spent like $7 million out of the $30 million we raised just for content rights in Malaysia, right? And if you have 200 people paying you $2 a month or $24 a year, you don't need to be a math genius to realize this is not a good business model, right? And we're like, oh, okay, because they're emerging markets players, right? Maybe it's the payment channels, right? Because our segment may not have credit cards and online banking. We tried working with telcos and said, hey, look, you know, can they pay via their prepaid credit or postpaid bill? We did some deals and still didn't work. And we're like, okay, what's the number one payment channel for e-commerce in 2015 in Southeast Asia? Because 2015 e-commerce was really starting to boom, right? So people were buying, they were paying money. What's the number one payment channel? Got to go all the way back to 2015. Take a guess. Before e-wallets existed.
It was cash?
It was cash on delivery. Mm-hmm. Right? That was how, because if you think about it, that was how Grab overtook Uber in Southeast Asia. because they were the first to accept cash. So we're like, oh, how's this going to work? We ran an experiment. So on your 29th day of your free trial, we say, hey, if you like our product, you're watching our TV shows, if you like our service, we're going to send a guy on a motorcycle to your house to collect the $2 from you, even though it costs us more than $2 to pay the guy on the motorcycle to come to your house to collect $2. But we were willing to do it. And you know what we learned?
What?
They still didn't want to pay.
No.
So now we're really screwed. Like, it's not the payment channel. We're sitting in a coffee shop downstairs from our office, looking forlorn and like, oh, we're in trouble now. But we're wearing our iFlix t-shirts, right? So coincidentally, this guy walks past us and they see us wearing iFlix t-shirts. Like, hey, are you guys like the iFlix guys? Hey, thanks for bringing iFlix, man. I really love your service. You know, I'm really watching Flash and Gotham and these Korean dramas. I'm on my fourth free trial.
Oh, no.
Ah, you know, like, okay. So they like watching it. The only problem is they don't want to pay for it.
Yeah.
Because if you make them pay, they'll go to pirated sites. But it's better curated, personalized recommendations and all of that. They'll watch it. And it's so easy to get a free trial account, right? The Gmail account costs nothing to set up. So that led to conversations. And the light bulb moment came when we said, ah, who benefits when people watch iFlix? In 2015, interestingly, was also the year that mobile telcos were going through a major disruption in their business. Imagine a big business that was losing 50% of their revenues.
Oh, wow.
If I were to ask you, what was your average mobile phone bill in 2015, what do you think it was?
Maybe 20?
It's more than double what it is now, right? Because back then, we used to pay for calls, pay for international roaming, pay for SMS. Remember SMS?
Yeah.
Like 10 cents per message, and you do everything in 160 characters. Mm-hmm. That's how LOL and OMG all came out, right? So their core businesses was disappearing because instant messaging was on the rise, right? We could send messages for free. And the only growing revenue stream was data. Guess what? Video is the most data-intensive application. 70% of internet bandwidth is video. So we're like, hey, we have something that can be very useful for mobile telcos. I was lucky, figured out how to get to talk to the CEO of one of the telcos and hearing him out first, right? What's pressing in his mind? It is, you know, for Southeast Asia telcos, up to 80% of their business is prepaid. And these guys change their prepaid subscriptions at a 50% rate. That means on average, they're only keeping their number and subscription for 6 months. And the price is going down, right? So he's trying to figure out, how can I add more value, right? And how can more stickiness? I'm like, ah, okay. Here's an idea, right? iFlix content. And specifically, no, it's not about movies. It's drama series. So once you hook on a drama series, you want, you know, episode after episode, season after season, right? So he's like, okay, this is interesting, right? Let's run a pilot, right? I'm going to give you this one postpaid package of subscribers, about 1 million people. And he agreed to buy a whole year's worth of iFlix subscription. And we're able to show that for those customers, if you provide a free iFlix, they would consume 2 gigabytes of data more stay for a few more months.
So
right?
Good.
And in 2015, how much was 2 gigabytes of data?
I don't know.
Probably about $5. Okay. iFlix costs less than $2, right? And then I said, hey, we give your customer a free car, then we sell them gasoline, right? And that model then grew on. And so the whole 20 million thing was on the back of mobile telcos.
It's so interesting.
And it's never in that business plan. Like it's a random encounter because one guy saw us wear t-shirts. But you might find the answer. But what is the answer today?
Yes.
Is not going to be the answer the next year.
Yeah. Wow. So now you after that you launch Naluri.
Mm-hmm.
And what is your wildest dream with Naluri?
Ooh, my wildest dream is people don't go to hospitals for chronic diseases anymore. Unless, let's say, you have an accident or you're going to deliver a baby or you've got cancer. There are a lot of other reasons. But today, 50, 60% of people are going for completely preventable reasons, right? Diabetes, heart diseases. And the reason why we built Naluri in the first place is because problem statement number one, hospitals or even telehealth models today are reactive. Mm. They sit there and they wait for you to be really sick. They wait for you to be distressed and you come to them, right? So we're like, hey, if you can find people with early risk factors earlier and help them earlier while they're still healthy, they're still going to work, we can reduce the numbers that are going over there. The second problem is doctors, especially with these lifestyle-related diseases, are good at telling you what to do.
Mm.
Cut your carbs, you know, exercise more and sleep better, Rodrigo.
Mm-hmm.
The 100% of Rodrigos will say to the doctor, yes, okay.
Yeah.
But 74% of you, when you go back home, you don't change anything, right? So it's not about telling people what they need to do. It's not about the answer, right?
Yeah.
But it's about whether you can be there for them almost every day, following up, coaching, problem solving when they get stuck, motivating them so that whatever lifestyle changes you need to make, at least we're more likely to be stuck because you're there for them, right?
Mm.
So instead of just, we expect people to somehow manage their health on their own. It doesn't really work, right?
Yeah, I love that. And also in your book, you mentioned that also there's a, it's really scary how the chronic disease are showing up at a younger and younger age.
Mm.
So you, what you're doing is to work on prevention, right?
Yes.
To work, I love that. For people who want to build successful businesses, what are the three things they can do in order to do it?
I'm going to answer that by framing as, how do early stage investors, like startup investors, make a decision on what to invest in? How does that differ from big companies making investment decisions?
Mm.
So step number one, the early stage investor sees a lot of business plans and pitch documents, right, from every founder who wants money. And probably the one thing the early stage investor knows with a lot of certainty, these business plans are not going to materialize, right? Everyone's got optimistic projections. But an early stage investor needs to make a decision. He's got to deploy, right? How does he make a decision? He makes a decision based on the founder or the founding team, the people, right? Are these the right people to tackle this problem? Do they have curiosity? How do I know whether they have curiosity?
Mm-hmm.
How do I know whether they have humility to know when certain approaches don't work? And how do I know whether they'll have resilience to keep going, right? The big business will tell their teams, okay, write me very detailed business plans, 10-year cash flow projections, optimistic case, base case, pessimistic case, risk management plans, business continuity plans. Oh, this assumption is not right. We've got to change that assumption, right? And you make a decision and you take comfort because you've got a very, very detailed plan.
Mm.
But we all know today, how many people in January 2022 predicted that Russia would invade Ukraine? Inflation would be at 40-year highs. Run out of chicken and cooking oil, right? Like you can't predict things anymore in today's business. Yet somehow they take comfort in the detailed planning. So step one for me, it's people. Second, the early stage investor, first of all, makes a decision to invest say in 30 to 50 companies a year after looking at 3,000 business plans. That's usually the right ratio, right, for these investors. Big companies, how many business plans do they see? Not a lot, right? Yeah. And they make a big bet on one business plan. So the early stage investor realizes, I can't just bet on one or two things. I need to make a portfolio of bets, right?
Yeah.
And maybe only a handful will break through. Whereas a big company somehow like, okay, this is the one that's been approved by the board. You must succeed.
Mm.
Right? And that's why you kind of, the business plans are never really groundbreaking because it's designed to like not fail rather than to really create a breakthrough because failure costs too much in a big company, right? So if you want to start something, you can't expect that you'll know the answer from day one. Do you have enough experiments and bets and options? And you won't know beforehand, but you'll eventually see which ones move, right? And that's why the third, okay, in a way it's related. Like you don't put all your money in one direction. You make a portfolio approach, right? But I think the last part to number three, very few experienced investors would make a decision to back a company themselves. They want to do it. Who are your other investors? And they probably like investors who are different from them. Mm. That means you're looking at the problem and evaluating the problem through a different lens. And if you also think this is a good idea, then it gives you more comfort, right? Because the reality is trying to build new businesses today, it's highly uncertain, right? Like by yourself, you won't have all the experience to know. But if other people who come from different backgrounds and apply different ways of valuing the business also think this is a good idea, it actually gives you more confidence, right? So you got to learn how do you co-invest, who are your right backers. Whereas most big companies, if you think about it, oh, we will own this 100%.
Yeah.
So we got to learn that you can't just start a business purely by yourself because no matter how smart you think you are, it's better to find other people who are looking at it differently.
Mm. What is interesting, I was speaking with someone from a VC. Mm. And what he said is exactly that. Sometimes, of course, the idea needs to be validated. Mm. But they know that the idea is going to change so much that the most important is the founder.
Yeah.
Is the founder has resilience,
right.
Has curiosity, and has the expertise to do it. So it's going in that direction.
That's right.
Something that I admire about you is like you find ideas and you become obsessed with it. Yeah. And you go through, I mean, the stories that you told is like so many failures, but there's a journey, right?
Yeah.
But there's so many people. Sometimes they have so many ideas, but they get stuck with fear or a lack of courage, imposter syndrome, whatever. What is your advice for people who have ideas, but they are scared to take that first step?
So first of all, I'm exactly like you described. I've got fears, I've got frustrations, I've got imposter syndrome. So to say that somehow you can overcome that, unrealistic. What I found really useful is to have what I call my mirrors. People who will help me reflect back the real situation that I'm in. Because we're actually terrible at judging for ourselves and getting out of problems, right? Like, we're really bad at it, right? Like, we don't know when the things that we say don't make sense. So we need to be able to talk to someone or a few people who will actually tell it back to us. And here's the thing. The mistake a lot of people make is, oh, so you mean mentors, right? And they reach out to people and, you know, can I talk to you? So the problem is mirrors are useless or less useful, one-off. You see someone, you tell, hey, you know, what do you think? And they'll probably give you a reaction. That's actually not very good because it's just a snapshot. The most effective mirrors are people that you see regularly. They understand your context, right? And they can kind of say, hey, but a month or two ago, you talked about it. How did that go, right? It also creates accountability, right? So I think the biggest mistake many founders make when they hear something like this, they think it is a mentor who they reach out when they are in trouble or when they're stuck. That's not very good. You also need to see someone regularly, even when things are going well, because they need to see the pattern.
So good.
Right? And that's what I think most people miss.
You went through so many challenges, mm-hmm. so many uncertain moments. Mm-hmm. Where did you find light? Where did you find that energy, that answer that you were looking for?
In a way, to build on the idea of mirrors. And I feel that, you know, hearing from different people matter a lot. So first, I have my own personal board of directors. 7 other guys, business leaders, we meet like at least 6 or 7 times a year. Because they're people that I know, they know my context. But we're very deliberate. We don't tell each other what to do. Most times we type A personalities. You tell me a problem, I'm going to tell you the answer, right? That's actually not useful. But to be able to create a space where people are willing to listen, they give you that space to reflect, and then you figure out yourself. But you learn because you're hearing how other people talk about their problems. Then you realize, I'm not the only idiot in the room. That by itself is a big part of dealing with situations, especially as leaders, right? You're not alone. Other people are also wrestling with it. And more important, because you see them regularly, you don't want to keep seeing the same people and say, yeah, I talked about it, but I didn't do anything since we last met, right? Mm. So that accountability is important. And sometimes mirrors also don't need to be very experienced other business leaders. Probably my most powerful mirror is my younger son. Mm. Because sometimes when you just share for the sake of sharing, and you also have to simplify your situation, right? Because you got to skip out all the business jargon and just say, you know what, here's what dad's wrestling with. And the fact that you got to simplify it for him. And then you realize he's like, he gives you a look that's like, okay, but carry on, right? And just even that one look without a word can be extremely useful to kind of give you that little bit of energy. Sometimes it's just knowing that you've got that tiny bit of energy to take one more step. You'll never know where you need to go in tough situations. But when you're stuck, you just need someone to give you a small nudge for one more step. And maybe in that one step, you find where's the next step.
Really, 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 really good. Right. Now, the last question.
Sure.
People ask you a lot of questions, but what is one question that not many people ask you and you would love to answer?
So most people know that an entrepreneur has to juggle many priorities. You've got to do a lot of things, right? And we're always pressed for time. So people are actually very naturally curious about time management, how you use your time, right? In fact, one of my most popular LinkedIn posts was when I shared my calendar, right? People are always looking for productivity hacks. What I love to talk more about that maybe people don't ask me enough about is this idea that time is a finite resource. We all have 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But energy is a renewable resource, right? And how do we increase our personal energy? What are the different types of energy? Because there's obviously physical energy. There's mental or cognitive energy, which actually is different from emotional energy or spiritual energy, right? And what are ways that we become more aware of things that drain our energy? What do you do about it? And how do you find ways to recharge and increase your energy levels? Because with the right amount of energy, you're going to get a difficult task done in an hour. But you try to do that same task when your energy is sapped, it's going to take you 4 hours. And then you complain, not enough time, not enough time, right? So I think that's probably one area that, that I think we all need to reflect and think a lot more of, right? And being deliberate about energy sinks.
And how do you do that yourself?
Well, so Monday mornings are my reflective mornings because I force myself to take at least a day off, right? So no running, cycling, swimming, or working out in the gym. Also because Saturdays and Sundays I'm more active and I need Monday for the body to rest. And I reflect. And usually what's interesting is if you look back on the last week, three things. One, who did you spend your time with? Some people will drain your energy and some people will lift you up. Just simply being aware of that is useful, right? Two, what are the things you did last week? Some big tasks, right? Which ones increased your energy? Which ones drained your energy? Third, time of day and day of week. Right? Because some of us are probably like early morning, we're kind of more energetic. Some people are going to really struggle in the morning, but they get high energy from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m., right? And no one has one pattern, right? In different phases of our lives, that energy patterns shift. Simply just taking like, you know, half an hour a week, reflecting back and saying, yeah, you know, looking at my week seems like, you know, Thursdays I got a lot more done, but, you know, Friday was just a really unproductive day, right? Why? Was it just a pattern of Thursdays or specifically the people I spent time on that Thursday? Or was it because I was doing a lot of expense reports and, you know, salary payments and all of that versus strategy and ideation and marketing campaigns? Then you're like, okay, how do I shift? Right? We don't talk enough about that.
Thank you for coming. It was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for inspiring us to be more curious, more purpose-driven, and also more resilient.
Oh, the honor is mine. Thank you, Rodrigo.